You're listening to the Northern Virginia Business Podcast. My name is Jessica Dubois.
And I'm Derek Wynn. Here, we chronicle the stories of successful business owners and executives who stand out from the crowd.
Whether you're driven by purpose or profit, tune in to learn how these leaders have built successful businesses,
helping to shape the landscape of Northern Virginia.
So I was born in Ouagadougou, which was in the country of Upper Volta, which is now called Burkina Faso in West Africa. My father was a foreign service officer, a diplomat, and that was one of his assignments. He got, I think, 2 years in Oslo, Norway, and 6 years in Ouagadougou. We were in and out of the United States, and as part of those overseas assignments, we were exposed to different cultures, different people, different languages, beliefs, ways of doing things. So I think it gave me an appreciation for diversity. And through hard knocks, you know, you had to assimilate when you moved into a new school. And as the odd man out, the American, the Yank, sometimes things were a little tough. So you had to learn how to adapt and survive and be tolerant.
You mentioned going from place to place and moving around a lot, and I can imagine that takes a toll. You know, at what point in your life did you kind of start to settle in and say, okay, now I know what I want to do, or now I know where I want to be and where I want to call home?
I don't know that I've ever had that experience of having a place that you call home. Sort of, it was always nomadic. You know, we'd get an assignment, we'd pick up, we'd move. There was a process to that. And it happened in increments throughout my life. And it happened also, I guess, as I migrated into adulthood and into the business world, I was where I needed to be and I was comfortable picking up and moving. And that's kind of how I've lived my life.
Do you think that kind of nomadic experience has played a role in your role in that business world to never really kind of get comfortable and maybe continue to, you know, move from place to place and redirect those efforts?
Yeah, I guess that part of the nomadic portion of that lifestyle is you get an itch every 2 to 3 years. So every 2 to 3 years, it seems like I'm starting a new business venture. Maybe that's part of it. But you're adapting and moving all the time. You're kind of nomadic, and it just kind of goes with it that you're going to adapt to where you are. You're going to adapt to the circumstances, and you're going to find a way to survive.
You feel like that helps you, we say, be comfortable with being uncomfortable, like getting used to hardship or challenges?
Well, absolutely. Getting used to failure too. That's kind of where you go into a new environment or you launch a new business. You know you're going to fail. You're going to have a lot of failures. That's where you learn. That's where the intellectual property is. That's where the solutions are. So you got to be comfortable with failure. And I guess I've had a lot of failure.
I want to know the first one that comes to mind, the first big failure that comes to mind.
Ooh, you're getting into the dark secrets of my life, which is where the nuggets are. Without getting into specifics, let's just say that I had a moral lapse and it forced me to rebuild my life from scratch. And that happened fairly early. And I had another one in my 20s. And those two things where I lost everything and had to start all over again. Those things fundamentally shaped my life. But at the same time, in those failures, there were people who were kind to me with a word, a deed, a second chance, a piece of advice, a challenge, an admonishment that motivated me or helped me in some way, shape, or form.
Who's someone? Give me an example of someone who stands out, kind of like your rock, maybe, or someone you go to in that case. Like, who was that?
It's different people at different times and different circumstances. But one of the earliest things, when I went to military school, I went to a school called Fisherman Military School, and the theme is leadership for life. And they live that and everything. And, you know, as a teenager, you go into a place like that, it's a shock to the system. And there was a guy that was our commandant. He was a retired British SAS commando, and he was a tough dude. And he was sort of a father figure to me. He was a father figure to me. He invested in me. He gave me chances. He did it to all the other kids too. But that guy was everything you could imagine in a British commando. And then you add in a little James Bond and you add in toughness and you add in the strongest moral code you could ever imagine. And that was someone at a point in life that made a difference to me and was inspiring. And I've had people like that throughout my life. There's another person, he's a retired colonel in the Air Force named Fred, Pete Peters is what he goes by, Pete Peters, who was a coach and mentor to me in my 20s, 30s, and even to this day, he inspires me, even though we don't talk all that often. He made a huge difference in my life. He kind of like helped me get the box that I thought I was in off of me and out of my mind and opened the doors to me of what was possible and gave me the encouragement to go forward. And the interesting thing was he was a military officer and a great leader, but I was a civilian and a contractor. He took me under his wing and I needed that. I was having a hard time in my career at that point. So it's people at difficult times that help you out.
So you talk about going from, you know, the civilian contractor role. So walk me through, if you could. So you're at Fishburne and you end up, you know, working. What kind of happens in between there? Like, how did you kind of get to that first position, you know, in that market?
It's kind of weird. At one point during my college career, I read the book On the Wings of Eagles about Ross Perot and his efforts in Iran during the revolution to get his people out. And that kind of inspired me. And when I was looking for a job, I keyed on EDS and took a lower paying job because that was the kind of company and culture that I wanted to work for.
At what point was working for someone else kind of something you didn't want to do anymore? And you decided to go off and be the entrepreneur you are today?
I always wanted to start my own company, but I went to EDS, great company, great culture, and I wanted to learn the business. I wanted to know the technical side. I wanted to know the sales side. I wanted to know the management and leadership side. For my near 10 years at EDS, I was able to do all of those things. It was a great company. They invested heavily in training. They were conscious of the culture, all around, full 360. They were about developing great employees that would have an impact. And I learned all those pieces of the business at EDS. It was a fantastic company. And I stayed there probably for close to 3 to 5 years, not because of the money, but because of the people and the interesting things that I was working on at the time. And then I got to a point where I was getting recruited and getting these offers for ludicrous sums of money. And I really didn't have a choice. I had to get out. And that was sort of my breakout moment at that point. But again, I'll go back to that gentleman that I spoke of earlier, the Air Force officer, Colonel Peters. He helped give me a nudge. He said, I think it's time for you to get out of the nest and fly. And he kind of convinced me and coached me to do it. And I'll always be thankful to him for it.
You know, when you think about your time with EDS, do you think today that you try to replicate kind of maybe some of the things that you saw there, like the way people gave back to you and mentored you? Are you doing those same types of things today?
Yes. I've tried to take everything that I got at EDS, and it was a lot, and bring it with me and bring it forward. And there's Ross Perot's legacy having an impact on people after he left EDS and he sold it to GM, and it's still having an impact on me and all the other people probably that worked at EDS and absorbed all those great things. So
you decide early on that you want to be an entrepreneur. At what point did you kind of just say, you know what, this is it, this is my moment? Was it just you woke up one day and said, this is what I'm going to do? Or was it a well thought out plan that kind of got you there?
I think it was just a festering thing that was inside of me for a long time, and I couldn't hold it back anymore. I'll go back to Ross Perot, you know, started the company, $1,000 check. This is going to sound cheesy, but I started Intellidyne with a $10,000 check in savings when my wife was pregnant with our third son. So it had been in me for a while, and I'd been, you know, like everybody, you're like, do I take the risk? Don't I take the risk? And I was able to engineer myself into a situation where I had to take the risk.
How did you determine what risk was at that time? Like, what were you willing to risk? And I guess, what were you hoping it would grow into or gain from it?
The risk was high. It was a new company, but it was something inside me. I had to do it. It was the time. The circumstances were right. It was one of those things, you know, the golden ring comes around and you got to grab it and everything in your DNA is telling you to do this. That's kind of how it was. It was scary, but it needed to be done. I couldn't really be myself without doing it.
Tell us about the journey at IntelliDyne. So once you started it, what were the first few years like?
The first few years were 100 miles an hour in 10 different directions. You're in the middle of everything. You have to decide everything. You have to do everything. It was crazy. It was fun. And when you're young and you have that kind of energy and enthusiasm, you can do it. But you can't do it in a sustained manner for a long time. So as it's evolving, you're learning when to step back. You're learning how to get balance in your life. And you get to different points in it where you have to prioritize some other things in your life because you've been shortchanging them for so long. Like your wife, your kids, your house, your lawn. You neglect them. And as part of the neglect, you're saying, I got to focus on the business. I got to focus on my people. I got to focus on my clients. And those other things get neglected. And then you got to find some other way to catch up and then get back on top of them. So I've been pulled in and out of the business in a tug of war on those conflicts the whole time. And I think I'm getting better at balancing as I go along.
I can't help but notice, I mean, that's exactly one of the things I was going to ask you is the timing. So you start in IntelliDyne, you have 3 children at the time at home, and you run 100 miles an hour for 10 years. You grow the business and you say, okay, pause. And you move over to chairman of the board, but you have hands in other ventures along the way because you're an entrepreneur. But you also come back this year. So 2020, you come back to the business. And I can't help but wonder if part of that is because, you know, maybe your kids are grown, you know, so you're not maybe playing that tug of war anymore. You know, is that part of it as well? Like looking at your family and those dynamics and where you are today, you know, and finding ways to allocate resources, which the number one resource is time, right? Effort, energy, everything else come through. Is that also maybe something that played into that?
I got to a point in stepping off in the business where, you know, I'd grown it to a point, I was kind of burned out. And I'd also lost my chief operating officer, who was another person that was impactful to me. He had cancer, he passed away. There were a number of things that happened that just, it got to the point where I need to say, hey, I need to hire someone else, maybe someone else with more talent, more energy, that maybe has done this before that can scale it to the next level. In order to do that, you're going to slowly extract as you're comfortable and turn things over to someone else. And you're going to try to manage to performance targets, you know, plus or minus 3 to 5% deviation from your budget and your growth goals and all that. So that was a process that took some time. You grow into that and you have things that work and things that don't work. So you're in the business, you're out of the business, it'll pull you back in. If things get off script or is planned or there's a legal, moral, ethical, or fairness issue that pops up that pulls you back in. And I found that at this point, I'm an empty nester. I wasn't getting the outcomes and experiences that I wanted out of the company. I don't think I was living up to my obligations and responsibilities to the employees in terms of growth. And I felt it was necessary for me to get in and get my hands dirty and take 100% ownership and be 100% engaged in getting the company where I think it needed to go.
Now, when you left, I have to imagine, so you had put years of work into the company. And I have to imagine it was kind of your baby that you cared a lot about. And when you left, like, did you feel like you were making the right decision?
I was unsure. You're always unsure. You don't, you go through the process, you get to meet people, you select, you go through, you identify, this is the right person. I trust them. They have the right value system. Mm-hmm. I tried to be cautious about it and extract slowly. You're in that position of leadership. You're going to have connective tissue with lots of different people in the organization, and you put someone else in charge, they're going to want to maintain that relationship and that communication because you're still the owner. You're still a person of influence. Your decisions ultimately are the final authority. So you got to do a balancing act on how you bring that new leader in and how you empower them and that you're not undermining them as part of the process.
And that you're not changing the culture. So I imagine you had already created a culture there as well.
Yes. And as I brought different people into the company and different roles in leadership, they have questioned the culture. They have tried to change the culture. And most of them have had to adapt to it. And the ones that tried to change it weren't really successful because the people in the culture just didn't allow them to be successful at doing bad things to the culture.
When you think about that culture, I mean, how would you describe it? And you know, you started this story and this journey talking about kind of the culture at EDS and why you went there. You know, you're recently featured in an article where it featured about what IntelliDyne did when COVID hit and how you decided to take a stand as a business and provide additional compensation to your employees. Can you talk us through that process and how you did that?
Well, the process, I mean, it starts with the, you know, your morals and ethics. I mean, people are, the way I was raised, someone's taking a risk, they deserve a reward. If they're taking an undue risk, you shower that person with love and praise and appreciation, and you find out what it is that's special about them, and you try to replicate it. So the journey through the COVID thing started with a value statement. These people are taking a risk and they deserve to be recognized for it, and we're gonna do right by them. So we found a way to keep them healthy, happy, and safe, and we found a way to carve out of our budget a way to recognize and reward that risk. And everyone rallied around it, and a lot of people participated in the process and made sure that it was legal and moral and ethical and fair. And there were no questions about what we were doing or why we were doing it, and that it was the right thing to do.
What type of response did you get from employees as well as the industry and the region around you?
So at a leadership level within the organization, you have all of our leaders, because of the culture, loved it. But we also have a culture of openness. And in certain areas and departments, they were extremely concerned that we were creating a liability, a financial liability that was too much of a risk for the company to handle. But as a team, we all came to the table. We figured out a way to get around the risks associated with that liability. And it felt good. It felt good for the team. It sent the right message to the people, and it reaffirmed who we are. It went over well. Now, I'm not sure how well it went over with our competitors, but I don't really care about that. It's about doing the right thing. And I'm not sure how it went over with some of our government customers, because they're like, well, some would say, you know, well, that's not in the contract. We're not paying for it. And I'm like, well, we weren't expecting you to pay for it. It just needed to be done. And oh, by the way, those people are loyal to you and to this mission they're on because of it, or as part of it. They appreciate it.
You know, maybe you've got a secret on this, but sometimes the fear of a business doing that when they go out and they kind of do these things that go above and beyond is that you continue to set a higher and higher bar where, you know, it's almost like it's to become expected. Like, do you feel that at all? Like in any of this, like, do you ever feel like, hey, maybe we've got to pull back on this a little bit? Because, you know, what if we have another situation like this down the road? Or do you feel any liabilities when you do that?
Absolutely. And that's, you know, there's certain people that's their thing. They're gonna look for the liabilities and they're gonna look for the risks. And you want really good people on your team. If you can get an actuarial that can do the mathematics on your mathematical science on your risks and tell you the probabilities with some accuracy, that they're worth their weight in gold. That's always there. I guess my personality is just like, if you tell me no or it can't be done, I'm going to challenge you on that. And that's probably why I have so many failures and secrets in my experience base. I fight authority. Authority usually wins. But in there somewhere, there's some innovation and good things happen. I like to think I operate on the kind side of chaos.
You came back as CEO like right before COVID hit, correct?
Yes, 3 months before. It was... We went in 3 months before we went into lockdown. So January 13th. I think we went into lockdown, what, March 15th?
Mm-hmm. So it's not in your plans.
It wasn't in our plans, but we had a coup plan. We had to dust it off and go back to it. But that's, you know, we're all over audits. We're all over certifications. We're all over process. and process improvement. So we had a good plan, and we've been through multiple, you know, that's part of our business, dealing with the government. So, you know, from everything the government's dealt with from, you know, shortly after we started the company, 9/11, all the way through, you know, snipers and earthquakes and national disasters and things that we've had to respond to. We've had to deal with coups for our client and execute them, and we have to do it for ourselves. So I think we're in pretty good shape when something hits the fan.
Well, let me ask you about another initiative that I saw that you put forth, and that was around making Juneteenth a paid company holiday.
Well, I think it was important to everyone and every head. You know, some people were quiet, but in our company, we heard from people that were for it, and we heard from people who weren't for it. And I'm like, it was a no-brainer for me. I knew in my gut that, you know, those words endowed, all men are created, men and women, all people are created by their, you know, created with certain unalienable rights. And that extends to everyone. This is a no-brainer. There has to be equal justice for everyone, and no problem with that. And that day in the country's history, when those slaves in that remote part of Texas out on the frontier, who had been free for a long time already by proclamation and decree, it took army guys to go in there and announce their freedom and enforce their freedom. And it extended, you know, the freedom from one coast out to our westernmost frontiers. That was important. That should be celebrated. The history, the details, they're important. That is part of the culture of America. It needs to be brought forth. It needs to be celebrated. Just like Martin Luther King and all our other heroes. No brainer.
There's a lot of angst right now for employers when it comes down to topics like back to school. And how do you handle that? You know, how does an employee make that determination of what's right for their family? And then how does an employer help them to feel comfortable around any decision that gets made? How is IntelliDyne handling probably the biggest elephant in the room question that not a lot of businesses are actually talking about right now? Like, how are you handling the back to school conversation?
We're engaged in communicating and dialoguing with our employees. And it's to the point where they're comfortable approaching their managers, HR, coworkers, and explaining what they're dealing with, dialoguing about solutions, and asking for help. You got to be able to have a dialogue about the reality of it and the difficulties of it. And if you're not having that dialogue, you're just wasting your time. And you're going to prioritize your family. We're going to try and help you do that. And we're going to help try and find a way for you to get your work done, whether it's people, process, technology, breaking the day up so that you can do your daycare, do your homeschooling. We'll figure it out if we can. And if we can't, we'll tell you. It's just about honesty and talking about that white space.
I mean, I couldn't agree more. I think it's really hard. The thing I keep on telling businesses is it is the elephant in the room. Because unless you're having that dialogue, you don't let your employees know where they stand. So when you don't let your employees know where you stand, they're going to do things like focus on work and feel like a failure as a parent. I mean, that's personally what I think is going to happen in a lot of this.
Right. Well, we have to have the dialogue, and it's kind of like a tough situation where even the having the dialogue, it becomes immediately a political thing and a us versus them thing about something as simple as whether you wear a mask or not, how far you should stay apart from someone. I mean, there's some science there that is suddenly political, and I don't get it. Regardless of where you fall in the political spectrum, these are real problems that face real people, and you got to talk about it. You have to work together to find solutions that work. In some sectors, the service sectors, I don't know what the answer is. I mean, when I drove through on the way to my farm out west, I was out west of Washington, I saw a lot of small restaurants that were closed down for good and other small businesses. And I'm shaking my, I don't know what you do about that. We're fortunately in the tech sector, and a lot of our people are essential. They're still billable, and a lot of people can work virtually, and we're fortunate that we're able to keep them in jobs. But again, they've got children. They've got to now deal with schools and daycare are closed. And so we're looking as an employer, and we're having time. What if people aren't driving to work? So we're not going to have to pay for their parking, and we're not going to have to do a subsidy to cover public transportation or other stuff. We're trying to scrape up where we're not spending money so we can reallocate it to solve these daycare and other issues that are presented by the current environment. Evolving to the virtualized workplace as a company has been accelerated. And that was one of the things when I took over as the CEO that I had on my agenda to do anyway. This forced the issue, and it gave me an excuse to put the accelerator down and make it happen. And we're doing that. So in some ways, it's sped things up. In some ways, it's slowed things down. On the client side, on the government procurement side, obviously, a three-month delay in the procurement and acquisition cycle anywhere is going to have an impact on the companies that serve that sector. And when you're talking the government, federal government and state governments, not spending money, billions of dollars aren't thrown through the economy. Lots of jobs that would have been created aren't being created. And everyone's going to feel that.
Derek and I used to focus on, it's funny, like we used to focus on the next 3 to 5 years. And it just seems like you can't really look past the next 3 months. I mean, really the next 3 weeks versus the next 3 months. And so when you look at the rest of the year and how it plays out, like, what are some goals business-wise besides, you know, we talked about health and wellness, but from a business perspective, like, are there any goals that you have in mind for the rest of the year?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, you know, you can look at this situation as it's just a bad thing and a delay. I look at it, I mean, wow, we had to go through an organizational transformation, do an assessment, restaff key positions and everything. This situation has given us an opportunity to do all that. It's provided us some cover, the confusion, the chaos and all that. And I hate to be this way, it sounds sort of Machiavellian, but you got to find the good in it. And we found the good in it. We've taken advantage of the chaos. We've reorganized. We've accelerated some things. The next 3 months, they're pretty clear to me. The COVID situation has certainly given some clarity to the gates that we as a society are going to have to get through to get back to some semblance of normal. And I think that frames, okay, what's going to happen the next 6 months? What's going to happen when we have a vaccine? How long is that going to take in to kick in? I think it gives us some clarity. It gives us a framework to look at the future. I think it helps in some ways.
And where do you see things for like the region as a whole? You know, you mentioned, I mean, you're in Massachusetts now. You mentioned a farm out west. You know, I know you live right here in this area too. Where do you see the region going, and why will Northern Virginia continue to be a place, maybe that's your home base, you know, with your nomadic lifestyle? Why will it be home base for at least your business or you personally?
Well, it'll always be a home base. We're in the federal sector. We're in government contracting, a lot of my businesses. And, you know, the federal government is one of the biggest spenders of money in the economy. If they stop spending or they increase their spending, it has a dramatic effect. We're going to be in the D.C. region. The spending power of the federal government is not going away. We're always going to be somewhat insulated. And the government is virtualizing. And as they're virtualizing, they're going to be spending money to do that. And that money's going to flow through the Washington, D.C. region, a lot of it. It's also going to go out to other areas. But the D.C. area economy is hot and it's insulated. And it's always going to be that way. And when there's challenges and changes, and the government has to respond to something, they're going to spend money. They're going to innovate. Great place to be is the D.C. area where that spending is happening a lot of times. And those decisions are being made. I love the D.C. region. And if I was a businessman, I was going to start a business from scratch anywhere on the planet, the United States and the D.C. region would be the top on my list.
Let's just say I've got a great product, right? And I'm able to deploy this product to help companies integrate. And I see applications for it in the federal government, but I don't have any experience in working with the federal government. You know, how does someone get down that path of doing that? what would your advice be to someone who has a good solution? Because you're talking about the ability to grow based on the government needs and where things are going. How does one even kind of break into that? Or is it too late?
You know, I've had this conversation with, you know, I have sons in their 20s, and we've had these kind of conversations. I've had them with other people, their friends and everything else. You know, sometimes I just break down, go hunting, plan a trip to go hunting or go fishing or to climb a mountain. Plan the entire journey, start to finish, all your meals, everything, your provisioning, your transportation too, your trek up to base camp, your all the things that are involved in that. Plan the whole journey, plan the whole trip. And you should do exactly the same thing if you're going to start a company.
That's good advice.
Successfully navigate, not just up the mountain, but down the mountain. If you're going to climb Everest, most of the people are screwing up on the, not necessarily on the ascent, it's on getting back down on the descent. They're planning the whole journey. Having enough oxygen, having enough food, you know, staying at the right places, at the right altitude, doing all the right things you're supposed to do along the journey. That's what I would tell them. I mean, go actually live in nature and execute a camping mission or a fishing mission or something like that. And if you can do the same thing with your business plan, you're probably in good shape to start.
That's good advice. And where are you at in that mountain today? Or you just keep on going up and down the same mountain?
So I'm constantly going up different mountains depending on which business I'm in. And like I said, I've got plenty of failures and scars. That's where the nuggets are. I mean, that's where your exceptional people just kind of pop out at you. Their real character comes out is when things are going wrong, when you encounter problems. That's sometimes when you find, you know, there's that guy that never says anything, who's quiet and meek and doesn't necessarily participate. And all of a sudden, you know, he's got a Superman suit on and he's talking and doing stuff. Those are interesting people that pop out at you and surprise you. And you find them in the gray area, in the chaos, in the situations that are unplanned, and they can make all the difference in the world.
It's funny you say that, because oftentimes you kind of pick up on the people who don't say much. They listen and they take it all in, and then they come out with something that's just totally brilliant, right? You could have a room full of people arguing and then one person says something.
Yeah, and that's where you're onto something there. It's one of the things you keep seeing in the face, especially lately. There are these people that are right in front of you sometimes, that because of all the chaos around you, because you're focused on you and your mission, you don't necessarily take notice of them. And for some reason, there's that one thing that flips a switch and you suddenly, you get the focus, you pay attention, and you realize, wow, this person is incredible. They have this exceptional talent or gift or some nugget of experience or a relationship or something they did in their past you didn't know about because you didn't engage with them and you didn't really know them.
Right. So it's taking stock of what you have, right? Before you go on a camping trip, you want to take an inventory. What do you got? Do you have everything ready to go? Right. You know, before you go into the chaos, who's got your back? Who are those people that are with you? And I think sometimes it's really looking at everything, you know, right down to the extra pair of socks you've got.
Yeah, all the variables in the equation. No, the one little variable you don't pay attention to is the one that gets you killed. I have a farm outside of, you know, where the unit, Little Washington is?
Yeah.
Yeah, I have a farm out there and do a lot of hunting. That's my secret place where I feel at one with my spirit and everything that's going on around me. It's a great place to think. And I find a lot of lessons out in nature that help me out, whether it's leadership problems, it's technical, it's process, whatever it is. If I get out in that space, I connect. Yeah, but I always find the Mother Nature thing is probably the most therapeutic and beneficial when I'm dealing with those failures or contemplating those issues at work, those challenges. There's just a million lessons out there.
And there's no distractions. You know, there's no device when you're out of cell phone range. You know, you might get a loud bird, but I think it also takes you to a point where it becomes less about everything around you.
There's a thing that happens to me in the woods, that, and I bring this to work. So you go out in the woods early in the morning. I assume you've been through the experience. You get up early, you want to get out before the sun comes up. You get out into your spot, and it's kind of scary in the dark getting out there. You don't have all your senses. You hear noise, this, that, the other. You get into your spot, and you settle in, and things are quiet. And after about 30 minutes, the woods come alive, and you start to hear and see things that you otherwise wouldn't. And your DNA, your hunter DNA comes alive. You're seeing better, you're hearing better, you're smelling better. You're in that hunt mode. You're alive in a way that you aren't anywhere else. I find that getting into that mode over and over again, very beneficial to and similar to what you deal with when you go to work.
Yeah, I mean, it's how a sword gets stronger. You know, it goes into the fire, you take it out, you beat on it, you put it back in the fire. And you're doing that, you know, in the very essence of survival. You know, they say the human brain operates at an ambient temperature, you know, optimal temperature of what, 55 degrees or something like that, because it starts to get chilly and you start to say, hey, if I don't eat, bad things happen.
A novice going out into the woods is probably not going to see, hear, smell, notice, or be as effective than a hunter, as a hunter that's more experienced and knows the woods, knows what to look for, knows where the game trails are, knows where the water is, knows where their food plots are, know that the deer in the winter are going to go out and find the honeysuckle because that's the only thing they can find that's green and nourishing. Business is the same way. There are a lot of people that are walking around in the woods that don't know what they're doing, and finding the experienced hunters and knowing what it takes to really be good at it, it's kind of, you know, hard to find.
No, when I was younger, and I mean like 12, 14 years old, and we would go duck hunting. You know, my dad was always the one that would first see the ducks coming in. I'd say, well, Dad, how do you see them? Like, how do you know? Like, how do you just keep on looking all around without moving and attracting attention? He says, easy. Don't look up. Just watch the dog. The dog will see him first.
I love it.
Yeah.
That's perfect.
Rob, really appreciate it.
I appreciate your time. And I'm here. Reach out.
Thanks.
Stay safe.
Take care. You too.